Coming up, Justin Termini and William Liu talking about everything going on in the NBA playoffs. All right, welcome back to Talk NBA Playoffs. Joining me from SiriusXM, and he just started a YouTube channel. Termini crashes out. It's Justin Termini. Justin, how are you?
Well, Termini crashes out. I'm excited to start that that new YouTube program, and hopefully it's a crash out in a positive way, not crash out like a la the Denver Nuggets here.
Well, let's start out. Let's get you to crash out here. Do you have any regrets voting Jokic as MVP?
No, 100% no regrets. I mean, I still think he's the best player in the sport. I mean, this is a regular season award, so I'm judging it off of 5 months in the regular season. The guy was the best player in the regular season. I know that we have a great difference of opinion because you put him third, I put him first. You went with Wembanyama. I think I'm more in line with what everybody else was thinking than you. Have we got a second Wembanyama first place vote yet, or are you the lone wolf?
So far, there is yet to be a reveal of anybody saying they voted Wemby. I know Rachel Nichols, she was on Fox saying, I'm split between SGA and Wemby. She ended up going SGA. That's the closest I think anybody has at least publicly admitted so far.
Well, listen, I think I'm a bigger outlier than you because the Spur fan is all over my case. I don't know if we talked about this, I think, when maybe you joined my show with Eddie Johnson. I actually had Wembanyama second team All-NBA because I only vote for one center, and I'm going to cost them a unanimous first team All-NBA because I'm assuming the 99 other voters put Wembanyama first team All-NBA. But I thought he was the second best center, so I went Jokic first team. I went Wembanyama second team, and the Spur fan did not like that much. So we're in completely different boats, you and I.
Well, you're right. It is a regular season award, but in terms of the playoffs, Jokic wouldn't even be on the all playoff team right now. He'd be on the all most underwhelming team right now because Jokic is having, as the Nuggets trail 3-1 in the first round to the Wolves, 112-96 on Saturday night in a game where Dante DiVincenzo and Anthony Edwards went out. Jokic continues to struggle. And in this series, on my podcast last Thursday, I talked about the domino effect of his lack of a three-point jumper. He's now 5 of 27 in the series from three. And because he's not shooting threes, the Wolves have been able to sag off him. That's influencing Jamal Murray. He's not getting into the paint as much. Murray's struggling this series as well, not getting open three-pointers or going over screens. Wolves are packing the paint. The difference is Jokic has always had an answer in the past, and Gobert's got him flustered. Jokic is making out of character, sloppy passes. Did you see some of the passes he made in the second half of that game? The full court, careless. That's not Jokic. And that's yet the domino effect here. He's not shooting threes. They're not getting into the paint. He can't figure out Gobert, and he just feels flustered. The only time he really put in some great hustle, Justin, was at the end of the game. After McDaniels hit that last second layup and he rushes over. It's just been a weird Jokic series for a guy who is one of the greatest players of this generation, who you voted MVP. This does not look like the guy we just saw a couple weeks ago.
No, and I don't even know what's the most frustrating part. Like, is it the turnovers, which are very frustrating? And that was an issue even after he got back from the injury. Is it the three-point shot? Is it the defense, which has been grotesque as well? And I've even been a defender of him defensively in the past because I think that, he's not Luka Doncic. He's a much better, like, people try and throw him in the same boat. But Jokic, like, is the best defensive rebounder in the entire sport. That ends possessions. That counts as something. But, no, I mean, it's been a layup line. So you get on his case for the defense. You get on his case for the lack of the three-point shot. And the other aspect of that, if the three-point shot's not falling, especially against Minnesota KOC, Rudy Gobert can guard him one-on-one, and that might be the only player in the entire sport that can do that. So again, it allows him to pack the paint. Nobody else can get open. There's no cutters, and that's what Jokic likes to do. It's the lost art of, like, the interior passing. That the lanes there aren't open, so it's just had a domino effect on the entire offense, which looks putrid.
I mean, Minnesota, like, Gobert has been magnificent defensively. Everything he's offered one-on-one. He had a great steal against Jokic where he kind of just one-on-one poked the ball away. Yeah. It's just one of the many plays he's made defensively to just outplay Jokic straight up. But everybody on that team has been great. McDaniels has been sensational against Jamal Murray. Ayo Dosunmu has had made really good plays. Randle, after a very poor game one, has put in great effort. I feel like on ball and off ball, he's focusing. And for Minnesota to win this game, I mean, they lose Dante DiVincenzo to a torn Achilles a minute into the game. Anthony Edwards, he's 18 minutes in, end of the first half. Bone bruise, hyperextension. It looked like it could have been a severe injury on the court. Denver was up 5 points at the time of the Edwards injury. The Wolves could have folded. And instead, we see Bones Highland step up, 7 assists in 20 minutes. Naz Reid, former Sixth Man of the Year, 17 points off the bench. And then Ayo Dosunmu, 43 points on 13 of 17, getting anything he wanted on the floor, looking like an absolute superstar. So for Wolves fans in the arena at that game or watching from anywhere, heartbreaking game. But between Dosunmu and the scuffle, that's got to be one of the most memorable Wolves wins I think any of those fans will have in their entire lives.
Yeah, so a couple of different things. One is, like you brought up Rudy Gobert there right at the start, and I know that's one thing we can definitely agree on. I think like end of the season awards, because you and I have typically both been high on him. He's won 4 Defensive Player of the Year awards. I don't know, how many times have you voted for him? I voted for him 5 times. So I've voted for Rudy
I think all 4 times. So you voted for him probably more times than I have.
Yeah, so I went 5, you know, I voted for him 5 times. He's won the award 4 times, and he does, you know, he defends him better than anybody else. I mean, Wembanyama to me is going to be arguably the greatest defensive player when it's all said and done, but he doesn't guard Jokic like Rudy Gobert guards him. I mean, Draymond will talk about how well he guards him. He doesn't guard him as well as Rudy Gobert. So like that to me has been, I think we can talk about Jokic's legacy taking a little bit of a hit. I think you need to talk about Rudy Gobert's legacy, like going upward. Like we should stop hearing all that talk about how this guy's got to be taken out of postseason games. That's one legacy. And then the other is you were rattling off like all these guys that are contributing. Well, how about the guy that brought most of those guys in, Tim Connelly? Like, Tim Connelly, that's probably the biggest factor here is Denver allows him to walk out the door. Then he goes to Minnesota, constructs a team that is screwing over his former bosses that didn't want to pay him. So it's like, I mean, think about it. It's like Yahoo gets rid of you, right? Because they're like, oh, well, we just don't want to pay you. We think we can hire somebody cheaper. You go to another company. Not only do you have success, you could screw over Yahoo at the same time. I mean, you got to feel pretty good about that. That's what Tim Connelly is doing.
I know. I mean, Conley built the team that could take down the Nuggets here. That's what he has done with this roster. He has adds Gobert, a guy who, as you said, when Gobert was in Utah, he had a reputation of, oh, great regular season player, but he gets run off the floor in the playoffs. He can't play offensively. He can't dribble defensively. He can't play on the perimeter. Gobert, he is better than he has ever been. Gobert is the best he's ever been, because I think that highlight from a decade ago where Steph put him in the spin cycle, that's stuck in people's minds and people think, oh, that's who he is. In reality, he had no support behind him on those Utah Jazz rosters to allow him to switch and defend on the perimeter. Yep. Now in Minnesota, he actually has some help and some support and some size, and he also has improved. If you talk about like a guy putting in work to his body, Dosunmu made the joke how he has 1% body fat. It's not too far off. I mean, Gobert invests a lot of money into his body and invests a lot of time. He goes to those retreats 2 weeks away, no social media, no technology. He does these things so he can be better on the court, and he's quicker on the perimeter. I think he's stronger. In the past, Jokic was better able to score on him one-on-one. Gobert is stronger now as well. I just have so much respect for a player or anybody in any field that has great success, and yet they are never become complacent. They keep getting better. And at 33 years old, I think Gobert is better defensively than he has ever been in his entire career.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could make that argument. And based off what we're seeing, it'd be hard to go against that. But I think the first thing that you said might be the biggest thing. And in Utah, he just didn't have the supporting cast to make it. Like, he had to do stuff that he shouldn't have been required to do. Like, he's guarding his man. He's also got to, take care of everybody that's blowing by Donovan Mitchell, who, was horrifically defensively in Utah. And now he goes to Minnesota. Everybody can defend. So he doesn't have to worry about, defending outside of his zone or defending away from his guy. He can take care of just his responsibilities and focus on defending Jokic. So I think that's the biggest thing, is just giving him pieces that make him look a lot better.
I think that's spot on. I mean, it's fair to say that that's a big part of it here. It allows him to be the best version of himself. And like you said, part of that is credit to Tim Conley. He leaves Denver for Minnesota and he constructs this team that is really built to take down the Nuggets. And you look at Denver now, the Nuggets are in a tough spot if they lose this series. Cam Johnson, he's a shrinking violet, 4 of 18 from three in the series. Christian Brown, worst season of his career after signing his five-year, $125 million extension in October. That looks like a potential albatross. Aaron Gordon, as much as I love the guy, I think Gordon is awesome. He hasn't proven to stay durable in the last 2 years. He looks like he can't move at all this series. Tim Hardaway was a sixth man of the year candidate, regular season player, once again proving he's not a playoff player. 33% from three in his career in the playoffs. 32.8% now, still struggling. Peyton Watson, upcoming free agent, not even playing because he wants an extension. He's playing it slow with his rehab. And David Adelman, their head coach, he's not a head coach that's a leader like Michael Malone. That difference is out there too. So I look at this team, Termini, and I'm concerned about the Nuggets' future as well, with all the questions surrounding, from the head coach to the depth. Everything besides Jokic, besides Murray's struggles, it's everything else around them as well that I'm very concerned about now.
The biggest concern for me, and I know there's a lot of, and you just ran down a lot of legitimate ones, is Aaron Gordon, because to me, he's their second most important player. As good as Jamal Murray is, I think Murray's their second best player. Aaron Gordon's their second most important player just because of the defense, one and for all, because nobody else can defend outside of him and Peyton Watson and maybe a little bit of Bruce Brown, but Brown's not playing a huge role. So defensively, and then just his chemistry, as good as the chemistry is with Jamal Murray, I think the chemistry with Aaron Gordon is even better offensively, but you can't build around him because you can never count. Like, he's had the injury issues last year with the soft tissues. It's carried over into this season. So now that's kind of wiping out two postseasons based off one guy's health. It's not going to get better as he ages. So you just can't count on building a winner around him. And Jokic, unfortunately, has just been, as far as any other star in NBA history, an all-time great, has maybe been more snake bitten by the health of his teammates than anybody else. Like Gordon, two postseasons. Jamal Murray cost him two postseasons when they were probably at their apex with everybody else around. And the interesting thing to me tonight is, like, maybe it's the final game for this core, KOC, but are they going to, like, and it's definitely the final game if they don't show some heart, if they just roll over and die. And I'll bring up one thing that I thought of when Jokic attacked Jaden McDaniels at the end of that game. Like, one, that shouldn't be his job. Somebody should do that. It shouldn't be Jokic. They don't have an enforcer. So all the other stuff that they don't have, and on top of that, they don't even have an enforcer. And then what happens tonight in regards to guys having Jokic's back? Your best player got ticked off like that and said, enough is enough at the end. And it reminded me, like, 1984, Larry Bird in game three, after they lost, they got wiped off the floor against LA, called his teammates a bunch of sissies, said they had no heart. What happened the next game? Like, Kevin McHale comes out, he clotheslines Kurt Rambis. So who's going to be that guy tonight? Like, it shouldn't be Jokic. It shouldn't be Jamal Murray. They have to focus on being awesome players on the floor, but there's got to be some guy on that roster that has their best players back, shows some fight, whether it's a hard foul on Jaden McDaniels, whether it's a hard foul on somebody else. Like, you can't be punked like they are, like Jaden McDaniels has done, and do nothing about it. Like, somebody's got to give a hard foul tonight.
Somebody's got to give the hard foul, but Jokic also has to set the tone. I mean, it's just, this is part of it with this series, Justin. The fact is he hasn't been good. He hasn't been good defensively. Guys are getting to the rim around him. He's not moving well. Offensively, he's not coming through. Jokic is a guy that, like you said, people voted him MVP. You still consider him the best player in the world. He has, sure as hell hasn't looked like it this round. And he's got to figure it out. Or this postseason was lining up to be, okay, Jokic faces his old rival in round one. Round two, he faces the new phenom in Victor Wembanyama. Round three, he takes down the Thunder. And then on the way to the finals, he wins the second ring and becomes a top 10 greatest player of all time. This is a
complete opposite of that result. Exactly. Like we talked about the road and how it would have been the hardest road like ever managed to win a championship. Up there with what? The 95 Rockets, who had a difficult road as the sixth seed and had to do it all on the road. Denver didn't have to do it all on the road, but you'd have to be 260 win teams just to get to the NBA Finals, maybe a third if they went up against Detroit in the finals. And like I was looking at all the 60 win teams that some of the all time greats beat on the way to just, you know, their entire career. Like Larry Bird and Kareem only beat 160 win team their entire career. Jokic would have had to go through 2-1 postseason. So if Jokic was able to be 260 win teams and win a championship and go through the two other MVP candidates, then that would have meant something on his resume in the positive direction. But forget beating 260 win teams. They might not even beat a 50-win sixth seed.
The sixth seed without their best player and without one of their key role players. And so Denver is down 3-1 in this series. If they don't come out and show heart in tonight's game, I don't want to press the blow it up button, but I'll be thinking about it and I'll be extremely concerned given, look, Jokic is on the wrong side of 30. Aaron Gordon can't stay healthy. Jamal Murray got to be looking at his situation as well. Like, hey, is this the place to win now? Because what's the next move for Denver? How do you fix this if they don't come out and show heart tonight and make this a series, force a game six, or even possibly a game seven? The thing is, like, they should force a game seven. Even though they're down 3-1 in this series, you're going against a team without Anthony Edwards. They should be capable of pushing this to a game seven. I just have concerns there about the leadership aspect. Adelman isn't the same guy as Malone. I mean, he might be better tactically. Yep. It's not very clear if he is, but he's definitely not the same leader. That's for damn sure. And then the lack of assets this team has. They have no young players with value. And guess who has their first-round picks in 2027 and 2029? It's the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Thunder have their picks in 27 and 29.
Sumo, what did they get him for in Minnesota? A bunch of second-round picks. But they gave all the second-round picks away when Calvin Booth was running the team just to get off the contract of Reggie Jackson. So, like, when you make mistakes like that, and again, like, this series is wholly on Jokic. Like, you have to play better. You're going up against a lesser team without their best player, as you mentioned. So this specific series is on Jokic. But in the past, they've been screwed over by cheap ownership, cutting corners, by horrific moves, by relying on young players, even in this situation. And I'm not like, I like the moves that John Wallace and Ben Tenzer made in the offseason, but you have an all-time great and you're relying on a rookie head coach with no experience. You're relying on a rookie front office with no experience in regards to the head decisions. And you're doing that along an all-time great who's running out of time in the heart of his prime. So, you know, they've cut corners for years. That's on them as an organization. This year, though, in the past, I would make some excuses for Jokic, the health of his teammates, the situation surrounding him in regards to what the team is spending, who, you know, the bench, no defenders, no enforcer. In this case, this is on Jokic, but bigger picture, the front office and ownership and the coaching staff. Can you imagine Michael Malone in this series? If Jaden McDaniels is behaving like this and Michael Malone goes, it's just who he is. That's not going to be the answer you would have gotten from Michael Malone. Michael Malone would have popped the blood vessel and maybe hit one of his own players. He might have struck one of his own players.
He might have went out there and been the player, the coach who clotheslines an opponent tonight. Exactly. It might have been Malone. It might be Malone doing that, but like I don't see Adelman doing that. And for the Wolves, odds are they win this series because they're up 3-1, but for them, I mean, ant out multiple weeks, even 2 weeks would be May 9th. That's two or three games into the semifinals against likely the Spurs. So I don't love their chances moving forward, but it's a hell of a win they had on Saturday night to move up 3-1. Showed a lot of heart of winning that game. And ultimately, though, next round against the Spurs, I don't think anybody next round is beating the Spurs. I don't think the Nuggets are. I don't think the Wolves are. The Spurs 114-93. Over Portland. They're up 3-1 in the series. And boy, the Spurs, this team with a lack of experience, not a lot of guys have had playoff runs. So much for immaturity. They're winning in different ways. In game one, Wemby has 35 points. They win without Wemby. In game three, with a 15-point deficit, they come back. Castle with 33, Harper with 27. Wemby comes back from his concussion in game four. They have a 19-point deficit that they erase. Harper has only 3 points in this game. Castle has only 16. Well, it's Fox with 28. Wemby is 27 and 12 with 7 blocks, 4 steals. My main takeaway from these 4 games so far, Justin, is the Spurs look ready for the Thunder. That's my number one takeaway from this.
Exactly. So that was the first thing you said was about like the championship medal. Like we're looking at it in Detroit, right? We said, well, Detroit's never been out of the first round. Is their lack of experience going to cost them? It has. That has not been the case in San Antonio. And the more impressive thing is it's just not because they're winning the games. It's how the games are playing out. To like fall behind like that and not panic and show the maturity on the road to come back and win 2 consecutive games. And then on top of that, to do it in 2 different ways, like the stars in game 3 KOC are Dylan Harper and Castle. Castle plays all right yesterday. Harper was, 3 points on 1 of 6 from the floor. So the 2 guys that led you to victory in game 3 are silent in game 4. But then you have 2 other guys step up in Wembanyama and De'Aaron Fox. So the fact that they can do it with so many different guys, they can do it on the road against a Blazers team that I actually really like. To me, like the composure is probably the most impressive thing. And the nice part about it is like it's a free pass now to the conference finals. Like you can kind of work out some of the kinks, get guys playing time, get guys comfortable in their roles, ease into the postseason by beating Portland now, who you're up 3-1 on, then having an easy time with either Minnesota or Denver in the next round, who are both beat up. So you have almost a free pass to get ready for OKC and be fully healthy.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like the San Antonio team, it was supposed to be a very tough path. Denver next round and then before OKC in the West Finals. Well, I mean, we'll see. Like Minnesota, in all likelihood, they're not going to have Ants for games 1, 2, and 3, maybe not even 4 or 5. And by then it might be over. It's just the reality.
Ant wasn't even good in the first. The other thing about like the Denver series, it's not like Ant was great in the first couple of games that he played. Like they were beating him with Anthony Edwards, not even doing much. So like if he comes back, and like that's a testament to how deep Minnesota is, how bad Denver is. But the point is, if Anthony Edwards comes back, he's just not going to come back at 100% Anthony Edwards. It's the same thing with the Lakers moving forward. Everybody's like, well, Luka could be back for Oklahoma City. Well, number one, they're not good enough to beat Oklahoma City even with 100% Luka. And number two, it's not like you're going to drop Luka into the middle of the postseason coming off a hamstring injury he hasn't been able to work out with, and he's going to be Luka Doncic. So, Anthony Edwards in future rounds, it's not like you're getting the great version of Anthony Edwards, I would think.
I mean, 100%. That's why the teams have to be careful with some of these guys as well. Like, you don't want Anthony Edwards to rush back for game 3 down 2-0 next round against the Spurs, and then he suffers an even more traumatic injury. I mean, we don't know. Like this injury that he had might have just been bad luck. It might have also been partially caused by the fact that he did just come back from another lower body injury. And so you got to be careful there with all these guys: Austin Reeves, Luka Doncic, Anthony Edwards, everybody who's hurt coming back, and with Wemby, even with him. That Tom Havisham talked to me on the podcast on Thursday about the research that's been done into players coming back from concussions. It's not just concussions they suffer again. A lot of them suffer lower body injuries after coming back from concussions. And so with Wemby, it's like you're still a little nervous about that. But boy, oh my God, game 4. Like this guy he is.
Here's my research. Tom, here's my research, okay? And you're a bigger research guy than me. I'm just a basic idiot. But game 4, what Wembanyama was able to do, and then 91 when Bert smacks his head on the floor and he comes back at the half. He didn't even take a couple of days off. He smashed his cheekbone. Also had a concussion. He torches the Pacers. So if Bert can do that, when he's got a concussion on the very same day, Wembanyama can do it, 3 weeks after the concussion, and I'm going to feel safe about it.
Well, it sounds like Wemby wanted to come back.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Didn't it seem like Wemby wanted to come back in game 2? Oh. Never mind game 4.
I'm interested to see what his explanation is, because he said yesterday, right, that he was upset with the way that it was handled, not by his team, but I guess everybody surrounding it. So he said he would explain more after the season. So I'm interested to see what he didn't like about concussion protocol.
Yeah, Jared Weiss from The Athletic had a report after the game where he said when Wemby was not cleared by the NBA to play ahead of Game 3, he requested an examination by an independent neurologist in accordance with the NBA concussion policy, according to a source. Wemby informed that independent neurologist that he was ready to play and completed an interview regarding his symptoms, but the NBA determined that Wemby was not ready to return. So Wemby was ready. The NBA was not. Maybe they did him a favor. Maybe it doesn't make a difference. Maybe Puka Nacua is right.
I mean, listen, he might be able to play completely blocked out with a concussion next round against Minnesota or Denver and win the series. The amount of injuries that they have and how good this kid is. So,
yeah. I mean, I'll tell you what, though, that this series with the impact Wemby has made, the Blazers this season took around a third of their shots in the restricted area. With Wemby off the floor in this series, they've taken 28% of their shots in the restricted area. That goes down to 19% with Wemby out there. They take 27% of their shots from mid-range without Wemby out there. That goes up to 39% with Wemby on the floor. So Wemby, with everything he did, he had 11 stocks in game four. And you see why people don't challenge him inside, because he turns you into a team that you don't want to be on the offensive end of the floor. That's what Victor Wembanyama does. And for a team that gets to the rim as well as the Portland Trail Blazers do, it's amazing to see how much of a hard time they have when Wemby's down there.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he's going to arguably go down as the greatest defensive player of all time with the stuff that he does. And, you know, that was the first assessment. You're like, Denny Avdia, well, what's the best player on Portland's main thing? Well, it's getting to the hole. It's scoring at the basket. You're not going to be able to do that when you have Wembanyama, so you're seeing it take place in this series. And that's the same reason why you assume Oklahoma City. Like, Shea likes to drive. Shea's not sitting out behind the three-point line taking a bunch of threes. In fact, like, Oklahoma City as a team's not a great outside shooting team. So what do they want to do? They want to get into the paint. And Wembanyama just changes the way that you have to approach that. So, you know, you asked me if I regretted the Jokic MVP at the outset. I'm assuming you do not regret, even though you're the only one up to the MVP vote based off what we've seen the first couple of days of the postseason.
No, I don't regret it so far. Not yet. I don't think I will. We'll see what happens in probably the Western Conference Finals when the Spurs and Thunder face off. But I mean, look, this year when it comes to voting, the fact they waited until Friday after the play-in games are nearly done, and you had some people, including Bill Simmons, admitting like the play-in changed their votes. It did make me wonder.
The playoffs would have changed mine. Like, if if Jokic is going to play like this in the first round, I would have no other choice.
Well, that's the thing. Should award voting actually wait until after the finals?
No, because historically, no? Like, you know, I'm Mr. Like old school, you know, because how many would you have changed in NBA history? You would have went back and changed a million of them. So I think the way they do it, just because of the historical aspect, you do it now. And then in the, you know, end of the season, you get your finals MVP. But no, it should be a regular season award.
I think at a minimum, there should be like an all playoff team thing, like the five best
completely fine with that. Yeah,
okay. I mean, I like how they do that in college basketball. They have the final four, like the five best players that were in the final four, as well as the most outstanding player. So I think the NBA should do something like that in addition to the finals MVP. One of the Blazers note, Bill Oram reported that the Blazers are prepared to make a pitch for Giannis as long as he is willing to sign an extension. This surprises me a little bit in the sense that Dame and Giannis did not work well at all in Milwaukee. Why would it work any better now? I think for the Blazers as well, you already have Denny Avdia, who's a very downhill, interior-focused player. I don't love the fit between him and Giannis either, so I'm a bit surprised here, but I'm also skeptical that the Blazers would actually be willing to make what could be the best offer out there for Giannis. Maybe they'd hope they can get him for cheap, but I wouldn't go overboard like some other teams might for Giannis.
Well, based off all these rumors we're hearing about the new ownership group, that's the only way they're going to go after him is cheap, because that seems to be a concern. But I don't like the fit with Denny Avdia. I don't like the fit with Jalen Brunson in New York. I don't think they fit if Brunson were to stay in New York and Giannis was to go there. And I definitely don't like it with Avdia there. My co-host Eddie Johnson basically refers to Avdia as mini Giannis, because they have like a very similar style. I mean, Avdia is a better outside shooter, even though he's not a great outside shooter. But, you know, so yeah, they'd get in each other's way. Plus, All you hear about is Giannis wants to be on the East Coast. The furthest you get from the East Coast until we get Seattle is going to be Portland. And then on top of that, like, is Giannis going to want to go out there in the difficult Western Conference and try and compete with Wembanyama and SGA and, you know, whatever the Lakers end up putting around Luka? Like, you probably have a better shot getting to the final staying in Milwaukee with this bad supporting cast than you do going out to Portland, even with better players, and getting to the finals in that difficult conference.
I think you're probably right. And for Giannis, I would want to stay East as well. And we'll be right back after this break. The other series in the Western Conference, the Rockets, they win game four to avoid a sweep, 115-96. Lakers are still up 3-1. The Rockets did show heart in this game, though. I mean, LeBron had one of his worst playoff games, 10 points, 9 assists to 8 turnovers. Lakers shot 23% from three. They felt like a very fatigued team. It was the first game in the series with only one day of rest. And the Rockets played desperate on defense. They changed it up, applied a hell of a lot more ball pressure, causing turnovers, making it harder for the Lakers to get into their half-court offense. Do you give any chance to Houston to get back into this series, given what you saw in game four?
I mean, do I think Houston, I mean, they have a shot. Both teams are horrible. I mean, this is, to me, it shouldn't be like the primetime series that you have to watch, especially with Durant out. Yeah, I mean, you give them a shot, but is LeBron going to lose four consecutive games? Honestly, is LeBron going to lose four consecutive games? Because all we heard heading into the series was, oh, well, if LeBron, and I think it's ridiculous, like, LeBron might be the greatest player of all time, KOC. It's not because he wins a series against a bad Rockets team at the age of 41, but if we're to buy into that storyline, all right, if he's the first guy ever to blow a 3-0 series lead, doesn't that then make it inarguable that he's not the greatest player of all time? You can't have it both ways. So I'm rooting for at least some stress in a game seven because I'd love to hear like the talking points from the media on that. But no, I don't see four consecutive, especially from an email. Like, J.J. Redick's going to adjust game from game. All Udoka's going to do is yell at his team louder.
Can you imagine if we actually do get a game seven? the LeBron discourse that's gonna happen. I mean, it's gonna be
rooting for it. Jokic is like, get me off the hook here, baby. Even though I wouldn't hold it against LeBron in any type of conversation like that, you know, everybody else is gonna make it the main topic. So like, Jokic would love that. Denver would love it. Some of the other Detroit, if they end up losing, it's like Donovan Mitchell. If Cleveland ends up losing, Mitchell plays like this, they're gonna go, yes, please give me a game seven, have the Lakers lose, because all they'll talk about for the next 2 months is how LeBron blew a 3-0 lead.
I know. LeBron could really cover for a lot of other players around the league if they let us go to a seven. I mean, they lose game three in overtime, Houston does. KD's not in the arena for that game. Obviously, game four, totally different thing, right? But, like, KD's laughing on the bench. The guys looked happy. The vibes were better in game four than they were in game three, where it just felt dead all game long. I wonder if it would be 2-2, simply if Kevin Durant were on the bench in game three and they had his insights, they had his energy, would it be 2-2? Point is that this is close. And Kevin Durant played one game in the series. He was not great. He had 9 turnovers. Yeah. Game five is not till Wednesday. Game five, maybe Kevin Durant returns. We might get Austin Reeves back as well. This series is not over. If Kevin Durant is able to return and be more like Kevin Durant, not the 9 turnover Kevin Durant we saw in game two of this series, it's not over, is what I'm saying. So I thought it was over. I thought it was over last night. It's not over after the Rockets won that game.
I agree, although it is over if they're going to bring Kevin Durant back, give him the ball about 10 feet behind the top of the key have him like create an offense when he's double teamed and he's a horrible ball handler. He's a horrible passer. They had all season to kind of work on something maybe different, give some other guys some touches, let them try and initiate the offense. They haven't done it. So to me, like, even if you bring Kevin Durant back, if you're going to do the same thing you've been doing all season with Durant, is which hand him the ball at the top of the key, allow him to get doubled, and then make a horrible pass out of it. And then when he doesn't have the ball, Kevin Durant doesn't move off the ball, okay? He is, you know, you would think he would have learned that in Golden State, playing with two of the greatest off-the-ball players of all time in Clay and Steph, how difficult that makes an offense to guard. But Durant, if he does have the ball, can't dribble or pass out of a double team. And then if Durant doesn't have the ball, he just stands there and doesn't try and get open.
I'm with you there. I mean, Reed Sheppard had a pretty good game. Got to have the ball in his hands, the ball in Amen Thompson's hands, and let KD operate off ball. But he's going to be in motion, got to move, got to see some motion. I'm not convinced Ime Udoka is going to install some of that in the middle of the postseason. Now, either way, though, as you said earlier, I don't think the Thunder, I don't think the Lakers or the Rockets have any chance at all against the Thunder. They're going to sweep their way to the second round. They're going to beat the Suns. That series is pretty much over at this point. We're on course for a OKC Spurs Western Conference Finals. Out east, the Celtics beat the Sixers 128-96. Joel Embiid came back in the game, first game back in the series. I thought he hurt Philly. He did not look like himself at all. He looked slow in the game. The Celtics got more open threes in this game than they have in any other this entire series. 10 different Celtics hit a three-pointer. Embiid hurt. I thought their offensive flow. Maxey wasn't getting quite as many touches or scoring opportunities in the game. Defensively, they were constantly in rotation as well. I'm a big Embiid guy. I love Embiid, but he is a shell of his former self, and especially looks like it on the defensive end of the floor.
Exactly. So I think this season, at times, he looked like the MVP type years Embiid on offense. Like offense, the guy is able to roll out of bed and still give you like 26 points last night, even though he didn't do so efficiently on 9 of 21. But he's still capable of reaching those highs offensively. Defense, not only is he not like a defensive player of the year candidate anymore, which he used to be, he's not even a plus. Like, he's a negative. He takes away from you on that. And it was even the case a couple of years ago, if you recall, when the Celtics played him. They just kept switching him out on the perimeter, and they were cooking him behind the three-point line. And now we're here 2-3 years later, so obviously it's going to be even worse now. And I agree with you in him hurting them, even on offense, where he put up the big numbers, because they made too much of a focus getting him involved. And maybe against some teams that is okay. I don't know what you think, but Boston's tremendous defensively. Derek White, I had first team all defense. He's one of the great shot blocking guards of all time. But Derek White's weakness to me and the Celtics as a whole is staying with quick perimeter guards. Philadelphia's got two of them. They got Maxey and VJ Edgecombe. They're probably the fastest backcourt in the entire NBA. But you bring Embiid back, it completely slowed up the pace. It allowed those guys to stay in front of Maxey and Edgecombe. So you're almost taking away, like, you're helping Boston with their biggest weakness, which is staying in front of quick guards.
I think that's 100% the truth. Like, for Philadelphia, you can't say no to bringing Joel Embiid back if you have the opportunity. He does raise your ceiling in theory, but it feels like he also lowers their floor against the Celtics team. So, like, that was all on the floor in game four. And with Philadelphia, Edgecombe has had his moments. Maxey has had his moments in the series. Having Embiid out there, it felt like they were almost trying to force him the ball sometimes. 21 shots in 34 minutes just led to less of a flow on the offensive end. And then defensively, as we talked about, they were constantly in rotation. And Peyton Pritchard, he did a lot on ball on his way to 32 points, but he also did some off-ball damage as well with some open shot opportunities that came as a result of the Sixers being in rotation. Pritchard, 32 off the bench, a guy who would have been the sixth man of the year again if he didn't have to start so much all season long. He's an incredible player off the bench for the Celtics. Boston, to me, they're one of these teams where they just have so many different strings they can pull with their lineups they can put out there. You saw Mazzulla in this game. Sometimes it's Vooch. Sometimes it was Garza. He played 11 minutes. He spaced out Embiid and his minutes on the floor as well. You have Kata, your interior guy. Sometimes you're going to go with Ron Harper Jr. or Baylor Shireman. In game four, they went with Jordan Walsh defending Tyrese Maxey. Did a pretty good job in the game as well. And then Peyton Pritchard having the ability just to go off on any night to support Tatum and Brown as another scorer as part of this rotation. This is why I think the Celtics are going to be the team to represent the Eastern Conference in the NBA Finals. It's why I've thought that for a long, long time. And the way Tatum looks now, the way Pritchard continues to excel in the postseason, I feel more and more confident of that the Celtics are going to be the team in the East.
I mean, like, and the only concern is they don't match up well, particularly well against the Knicks. But now one of the guys that makes that matchup so difficult on him, Mikal Bridges, might be useless. Like, right? He's not going to play with any confidence. And he's almost out of the rotation. I mean, he just played 19 minutes last game. But, like, at the half of this
so
game,
19 minutes for Bridges.
Yeah, exactly. And they're up by 18 points at the half yesterday, KOC. Boston is. And I think Tatum and Brown were a combined 4 of 16 at the half. It was somewhere in that ballpark, 4 of 16. And you're up by 18 points on the road. That speaks to their depth. And you're rattling off all these names. In addition to Pritchard, it's like Shireman, it's Jordan Walsh, it's Ron Harper Jr., it's Luka Garza. And if I'm like an owner around the league, I'm saying to my staff, whether it's coaching staff in developing guys or it's the front office in regards to going out and finding talent, how the hell is it that Boston lost Luke Kornet, Drew Holiday, Kristaps Porzingis, Al Horford, and somehow, like, it's like the Terminator where, you know, you shoot Arnold Schwarzenegger and his body grows back. Boston just grew back all these contributors. How the heck are they probably the second most deep team in the NBA behind only Oklahoma City when they saw all these studs walk out the door in the offseason and they just replace them and they might even be better. But I think they're the second deepest team in the NBA behind only OKC. Maybe San Antonio's there in the mix.
Remember a long time ago when Chris Mannix had the poll on Twitter at the time, and he's like, would you rather have Brad Stevens or Giannis? or Brad's like, Brad Stevens, I think it was Brad Stevens versus Giannis, right?
Now I'd rather have Brad Stevens than Giannis. I gotta be honest with you. So now, if you tweet that right now, I would vote Brad Stevens. If you voted that a couple of years ago, I was going, Chris, what are you doing? I'm voting Giannis.
I don't know. Brad Stevens is one of the best GMs in the sport. That's for sure. And you mentioned the Knicks and Hawks, that round one series is now tied 2-2. Knicks won game four, 114-98. And I picked this series to go seven. I picked the Knicks in seven. I still think it's going to go seven games. We're going to see Quinn Snyder make some adjustments for game five. But I thought what Mike Brown did on the offensive end of the floor for game four was overdue. Karl Anthony Towns, way more touches in the game. 10 assists, 9 of them came with him just in the middle of the floor, either top of the three-point line or from the elbow area, just picking apart the Hawks defense. More motion, more movement from the Knicks in the half court. And Jalen Brunson, he's been all ball dominant for the most part his entire career. Even when he played with Luka, he was could be on ball dominant when he had his opportunities, but especially with the Knicks. Game four, 4.9 dribbles per touch. He possessed the ball for only 502 seconds, both lows in the series. They took the ball out of his hands a little bit more, gave it to Kat, and I thought the Knicks offense just looked like it had way more flow, way more balance. And now it's going to be on the Hawks to have to figure out how do we contain Karl Anthony Towns, because I'd imagine the Knicks are going to go back to that in game five.
Yeah, and the key word there you said right from the jump was overdue. I mean, I don't know how often you've been calling for this. I've been calling for it dating back to last season, certainly
last
this
season.
Year.
Yeah.
Exactly. The lack of touches, and that's what I thought the coaching change was for. Now, I didn't agree with the coaching change, but I thought the coaching change was to change up the offense and to get Karl Anthony Towns more involved. They don't do that at all during the regular season. They wait till game four here, and the guy basically looked like he was, Jokic or, Bob Cousy out there, and initiate the offense with him. He's a very good passer. It was the most aggressive he has been, maybe as a Knick. If they found, like, the rest of the league could forget just the Hawks. The rest of the league could be in trouble if they're actually going to allow him to play make a little bit more like they did in game four. I thought it was an obvious thing. I've been calling for that for 2 years.
Look, I thought they hire Mike Brown and it was going to be Karl Anthony Towns in the Sabonis role, where he's playmaking from the elbows, facilitating guys, running through curls and screens and handoffs. It wasn't that. On opening night, or the day before opening night, Karl Anthony Towns was like, I'm not sure about my role in the offense. That was the first time I was like, huh, wait a second, something's up here. And something was definitely up all year long until game four. And it's the timing of the Sam Amick report this morning on The Athletic, where he said, Mike Brown, the noise surrounding Knicks Mike Brown won't die down unless they reach the NBA Finals. And even that might not be good enough for the first-year New York head coach to be safe. The timing of it is shocking to me, considering it comes after game four, where they made great adjustments on the offensive end. Defensively, I thought they did a hell of a job sagging off of Dyson Daniels and Jonathan Kuminga and other non-shooters on the Hawks sagging into the paint, forcing Atlanta to take more mid-range, more threes to their preferred targets, being a Dyson Daniels, Jonathan Kuminga, who was 0 for 6. Brown did a good job in game 4. It's just he didn't do a great job all season long. And so that's why this report still makes sense. But if you make the NBA Finals, I feel like he'd be safe, right, Germany?
Well, I would think so, but I also thought Tom Thibodeau would be safe last year by getting to the conference finals when I didn't think that they were maybe even the second best team in the entire Eastern Conference. So, I mean, this is what comes with coaching in New York, right? You're going to get that type of criticism. And they have, like, to me, I think them in Cleveland have and Kenny Atkinson's name was a part of that report as well, right? Where he's one of the coaches on the hot seat along with Nick Nurse. But those are the two teams with the most pressure. Like, there can be excuses everywhere else. Even with like Denver, they can say, well, at least we won one with this core. With the Celtics, we won one with this core. The Thunder, we won one with this core. Detroit, hey, we're still young. San Antonio, we're still young. The Lakers, like, hey, we always thought we were a year away before we completely rebooted around Luka. You don't have those excuses in Cleveland and New York. And then when the owner comes out and he says you need to make the NBA Finals and you should win it, yeah, of course you have to get there. But if they fight, like, and they should get there. Like, he should face heat if they don't get there. He should possibly be on the hot seat if they don't get to the finals. But if they get to the finals and they lose to Oklahoma City, I don't see how you could hold that against them. Oklahoma City, San Antonio, they're a lot better teams.
I think, you know, you mentioned how Kenny Atkinson was part of that report and Nick Nurse as well. Of those three, I feel like Mike Brown should be the safest considering it's year one of his contract. I think he should be the safest. We'll see. I mean, with New York's history there, Kenny Atkinson with the Cavaliers. Look, Kenny has had his issues as well. This is the second year in a row where Cleveland is just getting out-toughed, out-muscled by their opponent. Kenny Atkinson had his whole rant last year after the Pacers ran the Cavs out of the gym in the playoffs last year about how they lack a toughness, they lack an edge that the Pacers had. Well, it's the same thing now against the Raptors. I have a hard time personally blaming Kenny Atkinson there. I think this is just something part of the fabric of the players on this Cavaliers roster. Evan Mobley, as great as he is individually as a defender, is not a tone setter. Jared Allen is the guy with the famous quote, "The lights were too bright." There's a softness to him as your bigs. And then James Harden and Donovan Mitchell in the backcourt, neither of those guys necessarily tone setters with the way they play on either end of the floor. I have a hard time blaming Kenny Atkinson there for this lack of character the Cavaliers have. However, it's an easy decision to make if you feel like the coach can't get through to these guys to get them to play the way they should play. But I think it's something more about the roster more than anything else with Cleveland.
Yeah, I agree with you. One, they're not good defensively. And if you're struggling to like stop Scottie Barnes and RJ Barrett, what happens when it's Tatum and Brown, right? Further down the line, oh, yeah. What happens when it's SGA? You stand no chance. And then, you know, like Colin Murray-Boyles has been better than both, Jared Allen and Evan Mobley in this series. How should that be the case when the guy's a rookie and these two guys have been multiple postseasons? I don't understand that from a bigger picture. Evan Mobley's a good player, but has Evan Mobley improved over the last couple of years since he got into the league?
No.
Not enough for my liking. Jared Allen, in fairness to him, it appears like this injury is playing a role as well. He had that perfect chemistry with Harden when Harden first got over there, much like Harden had with Zubats, he had it with Capella. That almost seems like it's completely disappeared. We know what the Harden stuff is. You're going to get games like you got yesterday. And then with Donovan Mitchell, I think he's got to be the biggest disappointment because I'm assuming there's maybe one or two people that put him in the top five for MVP. There's certainly people that put him second team All-NBA. He's supposed to be one of the 10 best players. He hasn't showed up at all in two consecutive road games. I mean, and this is in the first round against Toronto. And he's got to, you know, we talk about Embiid never getting out of the second round. Chris Paul for years never been out of the second round. Evan Mobley's, Donovan Mitchell's playing in a weak Eastern Conference. You got to be able to get out of the second round, especially when you look. The thing that made yesterday so disappointing for Mitchell is you look at Detroit struggling with Orlando. You're going, the road is open for us to get all the way to the conference finals because the one seed is behind 2-1. So let's take care of business. We'll go up 3-1. We can get some rest. Everybody will be healthy. And then we've got an easier matchup potentially in the second round because we're facing Orlando instead of Detroit.
It's potentially the biggest missed opportunity for any team in the entire postseason if Cleveland does lose the series against the Raptors. And even if they win the series, the fact, like you said, they could have had time to rest. And instead, it's going to probably be a series that at least go six, might very well go seven. And for Cleveland to be in this spot is just such a disappointment. And we're going to talk more about the Raptors side with William Liu later on the podcast. But for Cleveland, I'm just beyond disappointed. I've always been an Evan Mobley doubter. I've been a doubter since pre-draft with him. I definitely still am now. He hasn't improved a lick in 3 years. He wins Defensive Player of the Year last year. I did not vote for him. I thought it was Amen Thompson. Mobley was better last year defensively than he was this year as well. He's just not a tone setter. A team with him on it should not be this bad defensively, struggling as much as they are. And for Cleveland, big missed opportunity given the fact that you had an opportunity to potentially face the Magic or a tired Pistons team next round in Orlando, up 2-1. The Magic, 113-105 on Saturday against the Pistons. And Detroit, Germany, they've played what? Like 9 great minutes in this series? They had the 30-3 run in game 2, and then they had the 17-point comeback in the fourth quarter before they blew it. And this Pistons team, they've just been outplayed for the far majority of this entire series. Orlando has matched up so well. I have real concerns. I had real concerns during the season about Detroit in the second round or the conference finals, flaming out, lack of shooting. I still wonder if Cade is as great as he seemed during the regular season. But for it to happen in round one against a team that was dead 10 days ago, Orlando, I've never seen anything like this. This is just hard to fathom.
I was here in Boston in person for the final day of the regular season when the Celtics trotted out, not their bench. That was not the Celtics bench. That was their G League team. Like they were starting guys that hadn't been with the team all year, that weren't sitting on the bench at all. And if you told me, hey, we're going to fast forward like 2.5 weeks later, and after that game and after the game against Philadelphia, they're going to be up 2-1 on anybody. Like, take the worst postseason team. They're going to be up 2-1 on them. I never would have seen it. But, yeah, I mean, like, in retrospect, the matchup is just horrible for Detroit because they can match their physicality, which might, you know, Detroit might be the most physical team in the league, but Orlando can match it, you know, blow for blow. Defensively, they're real good. Neither team could really shoot. If you want to tell me, like, if I had to pick one shooter from both teams, it wouldn't even be Duncan Robinson. It would be Desmond Bane, who, you know, they split the first two games 1-1, and Bane didn't even show up. Then Bane gets off the hook there in game 3 and is fantastic. Like, Cade's the best player in this series, no doubt. But then if I'm going through like the next five, not only are the next like, or four or five, not only is like the next four all been Magic, like, they're all more talented than them outside of Jalen Duren, who has not showed up. And going back and talking about regretting votes, I put him third team All-NBA KOC. I know some people out there put him second team All-NBA. He's getting his butt absolutely beaten in by Wendell Carter. And, you know, Carter's scoring more than him. He's beating him up on the glass. He's out-physicaling him. He's like, if you want to say the guy who's disappeared the most or taken a big step back, like, Jokic has taken a massive step back to what he was during the regular season. Donovan Mitchell hasn't been as good. We could talk about a bunch of different players that have struggled compared to what they did during the regular season. I don't think there's been a bigger drop-off from Jalen Duren, you know, second, third team All-NBA type of player to what he's doing right now. He's been like the 7th, 8th best player, 9th best player in this series alone.
It's just hard to understand because you watched him when Cade was out. He's averaging like 20, 25 points per game. He's higher usage, dominating. He does not look effective at all against the Magic. He looks like a shell of his former self from just a few weeks ago in terms of the physicality aspect, but also just, you do got to give credit to the Magic as well. Like, Wendell Carter has taken him out of this series. Wendell Carter, who's a very good center, offensively, he can space out if necessary. And then defensively, he can defend on the perimeter. He's a bit switchable. He can defend outside. He's tough inside. He's boxing out during, just out toughing him in a big way. And the Pistons, I was worried about their shooting all year long. I think that's a component of it here too, where with Orlando, they're able to clog the paint, which is limiting Cage driving lanes. It's limiting Durant's chances to get easy buckets at the rim. Cade, he's secretly been disappointing in this series, and it's not all his fault considering the supporting cast around him, the lack of shooting, Durant struggles and all that, but 6.3 turnovers per game, only 29% from three. I wonder if Cade makes a mid-series adjustment where he starts to use the mid-range jumper a little bit more, because so far in the series, he's 4-for-16 on dribble jumper three-pointers. He's 8-for-12 on mid-range pull-ups. I don't know if he's got the legs for those pull-up threes right now. I wonder if he'll go back to a little bit more mid-range. Those shots are a little bit more open, a little bit more opportunity, higher percentage for him right now. I think Cade's going to pull out a little bit more mid-range moving forward in the series instead of relying so much on that three-pointer, which has not fallen for him at all.
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of it has to do with the supporting cast in that they don't spread the floor. It's the same issue they had 2 years ago. Then they had, Malik Beasley, Tim Hardaway Jr. It helped a little bit last year, even though they still weren't a great three-point shooting team. And that's what they need to do in the offseason. They have to put pieces around it to make it easier for him to operate where he's the most comfortable, get into the mid-range, get to the hole, spread out the floor. And they haven't done that right now. So I think that's the main thing. It's like they were never going to win the championship this year anyway. You thought maybe they could get to the conference finals. That's where I had him going, only because I didn't like Cleveland's defense heading into the postseason. But it has not been good. And, you know, there's a legitimate shot that they lose. And if they lose, you would think there's going to have to be major changes in the offseason.
I would imagine so. If they lose the series, that's for sure. And, you know, I think the one name I don't think either of us mentioned in passing here, Franz Wagner. Him getting healthy as well is a big reason why the Magic are in this position up in the series, a chance to go up 3-1 tonight during game four happening on Monday evening. Franz Wagner, he bailed him out. They blew a 17-point lead in the fourth quarter, and then Franz said, no, we're not losing this opportunity with the big shots he hit down the stretch there. It's always been the story with the Magic, Justin. The Magic are at that best when Franz Wagner is on the floor. Franz has been the best player on that team. Even though he doesn't put up the biggest numbers over Paolo Banchero, he makes the most winning impact. And I think that's been apparent in this series in the first round against Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned, he hit the two biggest shots there late. One was the long two, the other was the three. And I've said the same thing you say. I think Banchero has probably the higher upside. Wagner's been the better player right now, though. It's about getting healthy at the right time. That entire team is essentially healthy at the right time. I mean, Boston plays the entire season without Tatum. They're healthy at the right time. Yep. The only team maybe health isn't going to impact is OKC, because they just have so much top-end talent, and it's their defense that wins them games. Everybody else, it's going to be, you know, hey, are we healthy? And I guess that's the part that makes it frustrating with Detroit. Like Detroit, unless I'm forgetting something, Detroit's relatively healthy right now. I mean, Detroit's not having any health issues.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the part that when you look at the...
They're still down 2-1.
And they're still down 2-1. And when you look at 8-1 series history during the seven-game first-round era, that's since 2003. In 2023, the Heat beat the Bucks in five. Giannis had a back injury. In 2012, the Sixers beat the Bulls in six as an 8-1 upset. Derrick Rose tore his ACL that round. In 2011... Grizzlies beat the Spurs 8-1 upset in six games. No injuries as an excuse for the Spurs that round. Zebo, Marcus Gasol, the grit and grind Grizzlies dominated that round. And then back in 07, the Warriors, the We Believe Warriors, beat the Mavericks in six games. That's when Don Nelson, formerly with Dallas, went to Golden State. He exploited Dirk Nowitzki in that series. We've only seen four since 03 when they moved to seven games in the first round. Two of them involved a lot of injuries. This one looks like that We Believe Warriors, that grit and grind Grizzlies team that beat the Spurs, where it's just the team was just better. It feels more like a 4-5 than an 8-1 right now between these two teams. Orlando getting healthy at the right time. Do you actually think Orlando's going to finish them off, though, Justin? Do you think Orlando does win this series?
I mean, I'm not going to say they definitely will. I think it's possible because I'm thinking of some of the names that you had on those other teams that lost. Like Tim Duncan's an all-time great, right? And he allows, you know, them to lose an 8-1. Dirk Nowitzki's an all-time great. So as good as Cade Cunningham is, he's not those guys. And especially at this point in his career, like maybe someday, that's a high bar. Maybe someday he gets there. I don't think so. Ever be as good as Duncan or Dirk. But if you can do that against a Duncan and Dirk team, you can certainly do it against a Cade Cunningham team. So again, it's possible because I like the matchup for Orlando. They're playing with confidence right now. They're going to be free of pressure. Like if Orlando loses, what are they going to grill them? No, they're going to say, well, they're the eighth seed. You know, they're going up against a 60 win team. Detroit loses in the first round. They're going to get absolutely grilled. So the longer this series goes, the heavier the ball is going to get and the smaller the rim is going to get for Detroit. So, I'll go out on a limb and I guess say I think it's going to happen. What do you think?
I think it's going to happen too. Everything that I worried about with Detroit all season long is coming to fruition in the first round just earlier than I anticipated. I thought it would be round two that this would become an issue for them, maybe even the East Finals, but it's all happening now. And Orlando looks healthy. Orlando looks like the team that people thought would compete for a top four seed before the season began. They're healthy at the right time. Like I said, like everybody talks about Duren, rightfully so. Everybody talks about the non-shooters and the Pistons, rightfully so. Cade's just going to be better too. I mean, 6.3 turnovers through the first three games of the series is not going to cut it. It's just he looks more like the guy from a couple of years ago than he did as the guy who was a top five, top six MVP candidate this year. He's nowhere close. And I don't know if the lung issue, the time off from that impacted him upon his return, but he just does not look like the same Cade Cunningham and all. I don't feel good about this series for Detroit one bit, Justin. And I think Detroit is and probably does currently severely regret not making additions at the deadline. Because boy, would this team look a lot different if they were willing to give up one of their seven future first round picks to go get an Ayo Dosunmu or to add another shooter to overpay for Michael Porter Jr. or Trey Murphy or pick your second level star, whoever it is. They missed a chance. They had an opportunity and they decided to sit on their hands and get Kevin Huerter. That's it. I just think it's that they must feel so much regret in that front office today.
I mean, and especially looking around the rest of the league, like maybe one of the top storylines is the teams that did make moves at the deadline, they're paying off, right? Dosunmu, you mentioned, CJ McCollum in Atlanta. Kuminga's played two games where he's helped them win. Alvarado was great last game, so he's contributed. So the teams that went out and like made moves are benefiting from them. Then you look at Houston. They don't make a move. You look at Denver. They don't make a move. Denver's struggling. Detroit doesn't make a move because I'm really not counting Kevin Huerter. And they're struggling. And anytime you got a 60-win team, if you can make a move in order to add to it, like you're a 60-win team in a weak Eastern Conference, you're going to regret it. And, you know, you're saying the same thing about Cleveland. Like, look, we could have Toronto. It's realistic. You could have Toronto and Orlando in the second round.
It's crazy. I'm sure Adam Silver would love that. Raptors Magic, round two. Hey, it might be an exciting series because I'll tell you what, the Magic have been a lot of fun to watch. The Raptors, they are tough. Going to talk about a lot about the Raptors with William Liu coming up next. But Justin, thank you so much for joining me on today's show. Today, people can hear you on SiriusXM every day with Eddie Johnson. And of course, now they can also hear you on Termini Crashes Out on YouTube. Thanks for joining me today.
Termini Crashes Out, NBA Today, SiriusXM NBA Radio, KOC. Appreciate it, buddy. And let's hope you don't have to regret that Wembanyama MVP pick like you do with Jokic. I stand by it for now. We'll see what happens tonight.
Thank you so much, Justin. Have a good one. All right. Thank you to Justin. Up next, we're diving deep into the Raptors, one of the best stories in basketball this postseason, with Will Liu from the Hello and Welcome podcast. All right, now joining me to talk about the Raptors 2-2 series against the Cleveland Cavaliers from the Hello and Welcome podcast. It's William Liu. How you doing?
What's up, KLC? It's been a minute, man. I think last time we spoke on air was the chip. So it's not quite feeling like the chip yet, but the vibes are very high in Toronto.
Oh my God. I mean, that definitely doesn't feel quite like the chip. That 2019 finals was amazing. I was in Toronto. We did a live show together. It was a hell of a lot of fun back then, and it looks fun now. In Toronto, tied 2-2. Dude, the Jamal Shedd play to force the 8-second violation just sums up the Raptors. Like, just the toughness of this team, the grit. Like, you could tell he knew right away that he made that play. He immediately pointed at the shot clock. Like, right up, he pointed. Yep. He was still on the ground. He knew he made the play.
This is the thing. I mean, from Toronto's perspective, this is incredible, right? Because if you notice, this is like Scottie's played 41 minutes up to this point, and he still has the pressure on Donovan Mitchell starting at three-quarter court. So he's already burning the shot clock as by himself. But one-on-one, you know, I think Mitchell's got the handle to cover it. But the dive by Jamal is like, it's genius, it's toughness, it's ballsy, because you miss that play, then, you know, it's a one-point game at this point. You miss that play, they can get an easy layup the other way. Like, you know, maybe they call a foul, there was a bump on the shoulder, you know, whatever. But, like, this is the type of hustle play that defines what the Raptors are about. Look, the Raptors are not a pretty basketball team, right? This is how the Raptors managed to win 46 games and put themselves in a position to be the 5 seed and now back 2-2 in the series. They have been this tough, scrappy, weird, no spacing, we'll shoot 4 of 30 from the field, but still manage to get it done. And Jamal's like the epitome of that. You know, Jamal's had like 2 points in the last, like, he's a starting point guard. Well, I guess he's been benched recently, but like, he's had a game with 3 points. He had a game with 2 points last night, but he's still a huge positive because he makes plays like this. Obviously, quickly being hurt, you know, puts Jamal in a bigger spotlight, but like, and honestly, sometimes I try to think about it when I'm covering the series from the other perspective. If I were a Cavs fan, show me one Cavalier player that'll play as hard as Jamal did on that play, or as ardent on the boards as Colin Murray-Boyles. Like, he's a rookie and he's rooting out a defensive player of the year in Evan Mobley and a pretty good starting center in Jared Allen. And he's a rookie. He's like consistently moving these guys around in offensive glass. And then Scottie playing with force. I think the difference in last night's game at the end was, with the Raptors down one, Scottie came out the timeout and literally tried to bury Jared Allen in the basket. Allen stepped up and contested the shot, but he got the 2 free throws and he took the lead. Meanwhile, on the other end, Donovan Mitchell has 2 chances. Once he goes against Scottie, another one he goes against CMB. Both times he's trying to flail for the foul call that wasn't there. And it's like, it's the playoffs. You got to play through it. Like, Scottie trying to dunk on Jared Allen, that's how you get free throws. And Mitchell flopping at the end, that's how you got a loss.
I think you hit the nail on the head. You hit the nail on the head right there with the difference in these teams. And Kenny Atkinson, the Cavaliers head coach last year after they lose to the Pacers, talked about the character difference between the Pacers and the Cavaliers, how they ran up and down. Every guy was hustling on the floor. And he's like, we need to get there. We need to become that. It's literally the same story right now between the Raptors and the Cavaliers. Mm-hmm. You're right. There's nobody on Cleveland that has made anything close to a hustle play anywhere near what Jamal Shedd did or what Colin Murray-Boyles has done. The offensive board he grabbed with, what, like 5 minutes left and kicked it out to Ingram, who hit one of their few three-pointers they made. And Murray-Boyles, the defense on Mitchell, one of the 4 threes, yeah. And then the defense on Mitchell between him and Barnes, like they just have so many guys. Like, look at Murray-Boyles, the way he moves on Mitchell, and then avoiding the foul, the slight lean back. Murray-Boyles, I felt like there's been a lot of players who entered the NBA and people compare them to Draymond Green. Murray-Boyles is the first player that entered the league, and I felt like it was deserving with what he can do defensively and the way he impacts the game without needing to score. He had 15 in the game as well, so he did get some buckets for Toronto, but he just makes such a winning impact on the game. And the fact he's such a rookie, it just seems impossible to me that he's this good already, and yet here we are.
No, it's the crazy part of Colin that the coaching staff in Toronto is always praised with Colin is that, like, you tell him something one time, he absorbs it and he learns it. And then he does it every time, which is something that coaches always tear their hair out. Like, part of the reason why coaches that go to the playoffs with, like, you know, you look at the Warriors, for example, with like 2 timelines with Steve Kerr. Man, the reason he doesn't like playing these young guys, because, like, I mean, A, some of them are boneheads, like Jordan Poole. But, like, these guys don't actually like adapt and learn these things, and they don't earn your trust as a coach. Versus with Colin, like coming in, they knew right away. Like I remember talking to the Raptors executives right after the pick, and I'm like, so what do you guys get? And they were like, he could have a similar effect to where Scotty did coming out of the draft in his first year. And of course, Scotty reached higher heights as the rookie of the year. But their comparison there was his body's already ready. He came in 6'7", 250 pounds. Like, you know what I mean? He's like, look at him. Like, even though not play, he's not physically bereft. And then also he's smart. Like, already he was going to know what to do on the floor. His second ever game, he had 18 points, and he went straight at Wemby. A lot of plays. And so I think Colin still has to learn a lot. Like, really right now, he's mostly going for left-handed finishes around the basket, a little push floaters, which apparently he only started practicing a month ago. Now he's hitting floaters because the Cavs keep dropping back on him. So he's got lots to go on the offensive end. But on the defensive end, like, you can't teach a guy that big, that long, and has quick feet like that. Him and Scotty, and they played a lot together this year because Jakob Poeltl has, like, a perpetually injured bad back. Those two as the front court have been awesome defensively all season, and that's why the Raptors have consistently closed games in this series with those two in the front court.
Last year in my draft guide, I had a stat involving Murray Boyles where his team, South Carolina, was 12.1 points per 100 possessions better on defense than they were with him off the floor. And with Toronto this year, even as a rookie, it was a 6-point differential, and in the postseason, it's been a 4-point differential. The dude just makes an impact when he's on the floor. Like, you talk about how he needs to improve offensively. I think that hits on just what a steal he was in the range they got him in the middle late lottery area. Murray Boyles is already a massively impactful defensive player and rebounder. I mean, Mobley and Allen, those guys, like, this is how many times do we need a story to play out where Jared Allen, he's the Mr. Lights Are Too Bright quote guy. Evan Mobley, I didn't think he should have won Defensive Player of the Year last year. I didn't vote for him. I voted for Amen Thompson. This year, he's even worse defensively. He's not as great, I should say, as he was last year. How does Cleveland, you talk about the hustle aspect, right? Mm-hmm. With Jamal Shedd, that moment he had. If you have a so-called Defensive Player of the Year, your team shouldn't be this bad defensively. But he is just not a tone setter on the defensive end of the floor for Cleveland. The fact they didn't, how do you not have a defensive rebound in the final 6 minutes of the game? That seems impossible. How?
I mean, they went away from Jared Allen, who was the only guy rebounding for them. Jared Allen had like 15 rebounds last night, and they took him off the floor to close with Evan, which should be fine, right? And Evan did get, to his credit, 2 offensive rebounds. But, like, on the defensive end, he just gets pushed out the way. And, yeah, he's got to contest shots. And, you know, like, it's hard. But, dude, you're making a supermax, and you're the defensive player of the year. And, like, you don't feel that type of presence or impact from him. Look, if you go back and watch the fourth quarter, there's a play where Jakob Poeltl, and, look, Jakob Poeltl has no bag, right? You know what I mean? Like, he's like a classic traditional center. He puts his shoulder into Evan Mobley, and he's got a very light chest, you know, and he just puts it in the chest and he goes in for a layup. It's like, dude, if you can't protect the rim against Jakob Poeltl, who can't jump right now with a bad back, and he's 30, and everyone talks about his contract. I mean, like, look, I'd obviously rather have Evan Mobley than Jakob Poeltl, but, like, when you look at the numbers here, and, you know, in a couple years, it's going to be $61 million taking up 32% of the cap. Like, it just goes too far. And I think everyone was right to be excited about Evan. Third overall pick. And, you know, he's done a lot of great things along the way. He's an all-star. He's defensive player of the year, made an all-NBA team. But ultimately, I think, like, people just, like, got a little too excited because, like, I think the immediate comparisons were to, like, Kevin Garnett, Tim Duncan. And, like, obviously that's, like, a huge expectation. But he just doesn't have the mentality of those guys. Even when you hear him speak, he's really soft-spoken. I didn't even realize that until this series when I got to cover him. I'm like, oh, okay, he's, like, really quiet too. There's just something about him that he strikes me as shy. And when I'm thinking about defensive player of the years, I think about, like, Ben Wallace, like, huge, imposing physicality. And, like, yes, he's short, but, like, you could just feel his presence, you know? Or, like, even what Gobert is doing to Jokic, and Gobert is bald and he's, like, you know, bursting with muscle. I see, like, it's Wemby and he's, like, a superhuman. Like, when I see Evan, I'm just, like, I could see how he's good defensively. He is good defensively, but he doesn't dominate the game. He doesn't impose his defense on the game the way that he should. And to be clear, Cleveland should be the favorites in this series, and they still are. But a lot of the reason why it's 2-2 is because Evan has lost that Scotty Barnes matchup. Like that used to be a comparison in year one. You can't point to me one time Evan has done what Scotty did in game three with 33 points. And even what he did last night, like Scotty's the go-to guy and Evan's the guy who gets out the way.
He's just getting punked is the way it looks by the Raptors right now. Evan Mobley is and Jared Allen too. Jared Allen, I don't know if he's fully healthy right now. He doesn't look quite the same as he did prior to his injury ever since he got back. But I just don't think it's an excuse. Like this team still should be up in the series. Evan Mobley's getting punked. Jared Allen is as well. Their wings aren't making the impact that you would anticipate from them doing in this series. And then Donovan Mitchell and James Harden as well. Harden has 7 turnovers in that game. Mitchell taking some bonehead shots down the stretch. It's like, dude, you know you can pass the ball out, right? Like you can pass the ball out of the situation when Colin Murray Boyles is just inhaling you on the defensive end of the floor and you have no space at all. You don't have to take this tough shot. You have James Harden out there to kick it out to if you want to. The decisions from these guards as well. Like Harden, I don't think he deserves the full blame for that down the stretch. I think it's more Mitchell. He had the backcourt violation and he took that really bad shot. But all in all, like the Cavs should just be better. Like this should not be 2-2 when you look at these names on paper. That should not be 2-2. And that's why Sam Amick at The Athletic said of 3 candidates, Nick Nurse, Kenny Atkinson, Mike Brown are potentially on the hot seat. Kenny Atkinson, I have a hard time fully blaming him. This is just the way these guys are wired. You said it with Mobley. He's more soft-spoken. He's not a tone setter. Mitchell and Harden, this has been a thing for them with years on both ends of the floor with decision-making, with choking in the case of Harden and not setting a tone for both of them defensively. I think this is just the character of the team. And this is the second year in a row, the same story's playing out as did last year with the Pacers beating the Cavaliers. And we'll see with the Raptors if they can finish off the Cavaliers. But I really do feel like Toronto has a real shot of winning this series. And it's in part because of what they are defensively that's going to continue. But I also do think Ingram could have like a really good game. Like he hasn't had a explosive performance yet. Like he was celebrating 420 last week, clearly game 3, and then game 4, 6 of 23. Wow, what's going on there? He's due for a good game, right? Like, you would think it's not like the Raptors don't have some guys who can have good games.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I mean, look, the Raptors as a franchise are not unfamiliar with playoff droppers. Okay, all due respect to DeMar, but we've seen actually this exact story. A guy posting up and then fading away with a brick. Like that, we've seen that exact story.
Somebody said to me in one of my group chats. Somebody said to me, "Why have one DeMar DeRozan when you can have 3 of them?"
Well, it's tough. But the one thing with Brandon, though, is like I think in game four, and I know he shot 6 of 23, so it's absurd. He got out to like this ridiculous start where he missed like 2 wide open threes and he missed like 3 layups. But they weren't bad shots, especially for a skilled player. And say what you want, but the guy is skilled. He's not supposed to be missing these type of shots. I think in that sense, he is, dude. Look, Cleveland's game plan for the first 3 games was we're going to top block him. We're going to deny him getting the ball. And we're going to pair that top block with having either Evan or having Jarrett drop back to the basket so he can't go back door either. So, like, there was not a lot of space for him to go through. And so that's what created a lot of the conversation after game 1 when he said, we're not going to win a game if I only take 9 shots. Well, ironically, they did win a game in game 3 where he took exactly 9 shots. But I think that, like, with Ingram, he was starting to wake up at the end of that second quarter there where he – got one-on-one against Strus. He got a mid-range. He got past Strus, got to the foul line, hit a 3 on the wing, and then hit the buzzer-beating 3 to send the Raptors into halftime. Dog, the Raptors only had 38 points, and they were up at halftime. So, like, those little momentum, changes, it all happened at the end of quarters. And I think Ingram, like, he is too skilled to keep going the way he is. Cleveland's backed off on their defense. They put Dean Wade, their version of a wing stopper is Dean Wade. They put him on Scotty in game 4. Now, Scotty still blasted through him, but whatever. Like, Dean Wade's not really a defensive stopper to that extent, okay? You never heard Dean Wade all defensive team once in your lifetime. But Ingram is now getting single coverage. They're letting him have the ball. And a lot of times it's like Max Strus and Sam Merrill on him. he is due. And I think from the Toronto side, I think game five, Cleveland once again is heavily favored. And they should be, because they are the better team. But the one guy who can change the calculus of that going into game five is Ingram. Because if I'm Kenny Atkinson, I'm looking at how I can throw the book at Scottie Barnes. I'm looking to even stop RJ. RJ's been awesome in this series with the secondary scoring. He's been Toronto's second option. But Ingram is now getting single covered by guys he should roast. So if the Raptors have a chance in game five, Ingram has to go 4:30. And honestly, if Ingram's getting guarded by Max Strus, as a Raptor fan, I'm disappointed if he doesn't have at least 20 or 25. Like, come on, what are we talking about, right?
I mean, I think there's certain things in this series that you know are a given. That what's a given is Toronto's defense is going to just, they're full of dogs. That's going to continue. Yeah. The opposite with Cleveland's front court, Mobley and Allen. Like, maybe Allen gets a bit better, but Mobley, not a tone setter. You know that's not going to change. Harden, Mitchell, I think they're going to be streaky. But if that's where I think the difference is, Ingram streakiness, Mitchell, Harden, their streakiness, do either of those guys have explosive 40-plus or even 50-plus point games? Do they just go off where you just nothing a good defense can do? Does Brandon Ingram go back to his first playoff with the New Orleans Pelicans 4 years ago? He was a 27-6-6 guy. He wasn't good in his second go-around with the Pelicans, and he hasn't been great offensively this time with Toronto either, but we've seen him against good defenses have great games. And so I think, like, this comes down to, does Ingram or does Mitchell and Harden have these big explosive games? Because that's part of the reason why we did see the Raptors win game three. Barnes and RJ Barrett are really good in that game. But there needs to be a Brandon Ingram game, I think, for Toronto to actually finish off this series. Where's your confidence level, though, William? I mean, like you said, Cleveland's still favored. It's 2-2 now.
Yeah.
Win two at home, and vibes are good. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. But how are you feeling, like, purely from an analyst perspective when it comes to the rest of this series, which is now a three-game series?
So coming into the series, I called it Cavs in seven. It's certainly headed towards a long series. It's either going to be six or seven. I do think that Toronto might relax a little bit going into game five. They fought back from down 0-2 now. That being said, though, I think defensively, every game they've improved. Now, granted, they were horrible in game one, so they had a lot to improve on. But game by game, they've improved every step of the way, and they figured out different matchups. Like, a lot of the playoffs is about coaching and finding the right matchups. Jakob Poeltl couldn't play in the series in the first two games. He literally got benched for an entire second half in game two. But then he's now back in the rotation because they're like, hey, turns out Evan Mobley has no bag, so we're going to put Jakob Poeltl on him. And we can actually take him out to pick and roll because Harden wants to pick and roll with Allen instead of Mobley. So they found ways to sort of get him on the floor. I think Scottie's defensive effort is never going to change no matter what. He's taking one of the two guys out the game, basically, depending on who he wants to guard, Mitchell or Harden. I think he's been guarding more Mitchell, which I think is the right thing to do there. Look, those guys are so good offensively that they're liable to go off. But I still think that, especially with two games in Cleveland, the home game has won every game so far in the series. I still think that I'm going to stick with Cavs in seven. But as a Raptor fan, I can really acknowledge that, like, they have been the better. The coaching has been better. And I'm not going to lie, I was never that impressed with Darko's coaching tactically in the three seasons I've seen him in the regular season. But this year in the playoffs has shown me so much. He's been willing to go away from, like, who thought Jamison Battle was going to save the series, man? Like, and he went with him over Brandon Ingram. Like, you bench a star player. You know, the last time I saw the Raptors do that was Dwayne Casey benching DeMar DeRozan. A, they lost that game in the LeBronto game. And then fast forward a couple weeks, DeMar's traded to San Antonio for Kawhi, and Dwayne's fired, and he's holding Coach of the Year with no team. You know, that's what happens when you bench your star player. But he was able to still ride it out with Ingram, and obviously the Raptors won game three. So I think actually Darko's done a really good job coaching this series. And I guess I didn't know what to expect from him because we've never seen him as a head coach in the NBA in a playoff series. But he's kind of doing circles around Kenny Atkinson. Again, Kenny has the better team. He's the better hand. But Darko's outplaying him so far. So, oh man, in my heart, I want to say Raps in seven, but I do think actually the Cavs probably still take it in seven, unfortunately.
I mean, I just think, like I said, I probably on my podcast 100 times over the last year, I've referenced that Kenny Atkinson conversation, the post-game presser he had after the Pacers beat him, just because I thought it was so telling. And it just feels like that right now between these two teams. So yeah. I think Cleveland is the logical pick They have the better roster. They have the offensive firepower with Harden and Mitchell in the backcourt. I mean, Mobley can maybe turn it on. Like, sometimes he does have occasionally big games. It's not impossible for him to do that. But, boy, like, Toronto, just like you said, they were not so good game one defensively. Scottie Barnes didn't look like himself defensively in game one. No. He's been excellent ever since then. Everybody's been excellent defensively since then for Toronto. I want the Raptors to be the team.
That's what I want to hear, KOC.
I want it to be the Raptors. They have a lot of guys I like on their team. Like even Jacoby Walter. I mean, I love that shirt. Like Jacoby Walter. I was a big fan of him in the draft. I loved Murray Boyles. Like they have a lot of, I love Mamu. I thought he deserved a little bit more Sixth Man of the Year consideration. I just love a lot of the guys on the Raptors. And Jamal Shedd, like, he's a guy in college. Oh. He just loved that dude for years. Like, he's just impossible not to play him on the floor. And he's become the same guy in the NBA that he was in college. Not so good of a shooter, but makes the right decisions, constantly plays hard, sets a tone for your team. That's who he was for Houston and his years in college playing there. And that's what he is now for the Raptors. And the fact they're, look, I thought for sure when it was announced quickly was going to be out, I was like, well, Raptors don't have enough. They don't have enough juice. They're not going to be able to compete with the Cavaliers offense. And then they win a game.
Well, you're right about the juice on offense. Okay. They had. You're 100% right. Trust yourself on that. No, but I think, look, the bigger picture for the Raptors was like, you know, they had this like feel good season. 46 wins. They made it back to the playoffs. Their goal was the top six, made it to the playoffs. But I always thought about going into the playoffs, like, you know, you could be a lot of young teams. Like, a lot of young teams reach the playoffs and then they just fade away. And, you know, it's like, oh, that was just an accident, or, you know, they had a decent run. I looked at it like my goal for the Raptors going into this series was like, can you replicate what Detroit did last year to New York? It's like, yeah, the Pistons lost in the first round. And clearly we're seeing the Pistons still have issues right now because they're struggling with Orlando. But, like, the Pistons announced themselves as a young team. And they actually took two games off an opponent that's better than them. And that cemented their confidence to keep building in this program. This was a prove it year. You forget people going into this year. Masai was let go right after day one of the draft. It was so weird, actually. I've never seen that. But right after the draft, he was let go the next day. Clearly, that was planned for a while. And it was like Bobby, the GM, was only given like a 1 year bump on his contract. And Darko was going into year three or four of his contract. And it was a prove it year for everybody. Even going into the year, like, the whole conversations are like, look, if you don't show us something this year, we might have to pivot again. And they showed in the regular season, but they also never really beat top end competition in the regular season. I mean, they did have a win over Detroit. They did have a win over OKC, but they lost, like, they got swept by pretty much everyone else relevant. But this year in the playoffs, they're showing that they can get to the next level. And I think for a young team, the biggest thing is, you go to the playoffs with a young team, you go through these really difficult games, all these practices, all the detail, like, it levels up your young guys. And if they're able to, like, the Raptors aren't winning no championship this year, even though the East is wide open. But they're not a championship team, we know that. But this is going to be such a valuable experience for Colin, for Jacoby Walter, for Jamal Shedd, even for Scottie. Like, this is his first playoff series where he's been the guy, right? First time he made the playoffs, like, you know, he Joel Embiid stepped on his foot in game one. He was on his way to a triple-double, and Joel Embiid stepped on his foot, and he was never right the rest of the series. He missed, like, two games and came back, and he was clearly hobbled. This is different, though. I think these two wins, even if these are the only two wins the Raptors get in the series, and they flame out in six, they've shown to themselves that this project is worth investing in, and they've shown it to the world that they're a competitive team. And that was the bigger picture going into the series, not necessarily whether they win or not.
I'm intrigued by how you brought up. Yeah, of course. I definitely want them to win in advance, especially next round. It could be Orlando or a shaky Pistons team. You never know if Toronto could find themselves in these conference finals. You know, you never know. And so I think with the Raptors, you bring up that Pistons comparison with what they did competing against the Knicks last year. The Pistons, they made some moves around the edges last season. Last summer, they signed Danish Jenkins as a two-way guy. They traded for Duncan Robinson, and, you know, they signed Caris LeVert, re-signed him, re-signed Paul Reed. They made some moves around the edges. But they kept the core of the roster largely the same. Even at the trade deadline, they traded Jaden Ivey, they get Kevin Herter, nothing big. They probably should have done something more. Do you think the Raptors have shown enough to be a team that is really going out there using their future picks to try to make an aggressive move? Or do you think it's more continue with the young core and grow a little bit more slowly at this point?
I don't think they should fast track their development. Okay. Like I think that right now the takeaways from this series are Scotty, his game plays well in the playoffs. Maybe regular season, you don't think of him as like some sort of superstar, although he was amazing defensively and a really good team player, and occasionally can really light it up offensively, but he's taken his game to the next level. Like the best part about knowing a young guy is seeing that his game actually works in the playoffs, because like that's a big separating factor for a lot of young players. So that's already a big takeaway. And then you know Colin is a guy you compare him with, right? And it's a very unique thing because neither of them are really a center, but when they play the 4-5 together, it's like the way modern defense should be played is with a Scotty Barnes and Colin Murray-Boyles playing in your front court, right? So now the goal is, can you improve like your scoring? Like, I mean, look, the Raptors had 93 points yesterday, man. Like they need more scoring. And yeah, IQ's been out, but is he the long-term answer for you there? RJ, there's a lot of questions about RJ. His name always gets put into trade rumors. He's actually played so well that it's like, you kind of have to like at least entertain the thought of extending him. I feel like in the past, the front office was not as enthusiastic about RJ, hence why you heard his name in trade talks all the time. But like, yeah, like, you know, is he a long-term piece going forward for you? And then even with BI, like, is that the number one option for you? Or is continuing the DeMar DeRozan, you know, comparison? Look, DeMar was great for the Raptors. He's a Raptor legend. He should get his number retired in Toronto. He's like the all-time franchise leading scorer. But the biggest thing DeMar gave the Raptors at the end of the day, aside from setting the culture for the run, was he gave them Kawhi Leonard upon his exit, you know, and that could happen with Brandon. And the good thing with the Raptors is they still own all their first round picks. That's the part that's funny watching this series. Like Cleveland's all in. Like they're the, like basically the most expensive team in the league. They're all in. You know, and this is it. Like the last pivot was Harden. Other than that, you kind of have to break this thing up. You know, even teams like Orlando are all in. New York's all in. Toronto actually has all their picks, so they have the flexibility. But the next step has to be, obviously, the young guys keeping growing, but you have to make another version of like that Kawhi-type trade, because like Scotty can be a number one, and he's so far been awesome right now as a number one. But ideally, he does so much for you defensively that he's your number two, and then you bring in like a bona fide number one, which we've seen in Toronto. So who knows, man? I mean, Bobby pulled off the last Kawhi trade. Maybe he can do it again.
I'm guessing you were not in favor of those AD rumors midseason, just based off everything you just said, right? Is that fair to say you were not in favor of trading for Anthony Davis?
I didn't even entertain them so much because I don't know how seriously the Raptors wanted to get involved there. And then I was definitely against the Sabonis rumors. I don't know, man. Well, for sure. That's just a bad contract.
If Nikola Jokic, yes, please.
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, okay, hold on. Yes.
Well, it's like, you know, it's Charmander to Charizard with Sabonis to Jokic.
it's disrespectful to put him in the same evolutionary line, man.
I know. It really is. Yeah. I mean, but to me, like, even with Giannis, I'd be a little hesitant to give up what I'm sure the Bucks would want.
It's just not the right fit, really.
I agree.
You know, Scottie's kind of playing that Giannis-esque role. Mm-hmm. So, like, no one's ever said we should have two Giannises. I guess, actually, never mind. That would be kind of cool just to think about what that would look like. But, I think they need, like, a Mitchell or even Harden. Not those guys in particular, but they need that type of player in the backcourt to give them more of a dynamic sort of scoring punch. Because, like, living and dying by Ingram missing layups and stuff is kind of worrisome to me. I don't know if I want to have this experience every year, you know? So,
well, in my mock draft, my last two mocks, I've had Bennett Sturts out of Iowa, point guard, going to the Raptors with the 19th pick. Are you caught up with the draft at all, or are you just all in while the Raptors wait for the draft in June? There's a lot of point guards in this year's class. There's a lot of guards.
That is good to hear, KO. So you know how this goes, okay? Everybody is too lazy to do the draft, and then we steal your draft content. And we're like, yeah, this guy Ben, the Raptors should go for Bennett or whatever. So You know, like everyone just steals the work. It is what it is, you know. I think for the Raptors, they just never draft point guards. That's the one thing. I know. You know, like if I had to guess, the Raptors are drafting another 6'7" wing. I'm telling you, you know how this front office moves.
I know. It probably will
Who's 6'7" has incredible box score stats across the board, but isn't a good 3-point shooter? That's what the Raptors are taking, I promise. Well,
they're going to, in that case, they're going to take Koa Pete from Arizona.
There you go. Okay, I actually know him. There you go. Come on down, Koa man.
Pete he's a family of football players. That's where he comes from.
Great.
He plays like it. He doesn't shoot. He's just strong. He looks like
look at Raptors Cavs game 4. That was basically football. That wasn't even basketball, man. Jamal's diving out of bounds, man.
Exactly. Well, I mean, William, thank you so much for joining me on today's show, man. Great job with the podcast with you and Alex. We'll definitely have to talk again very soon.
All right. Cheers, Kevin.
Big thank you to William Liu and Justin Termini for joining me on today's episode. Hope you enjoyed giving us a listen. We will be back again later this week with more playoff talk, some draft talk as well. A lot going on in the NBA world. Have a good week, everybody.